ACCA, the world's most forward-thinking professional accountancy body.
If a black swan is something that takes you broadly, exponentially, where you don't want to go, what would it be like to have things that took you exponentially where you did?
So I actually am pretty optimistic because I feel that the newer generation is much more socially aware and are not as old school about philanthropy and investment being two separate pools, and are much more interested in seeing how can we combine the two.
As we look around at how our economies, markets, and societies work, and think about what they might look like in the future, we probably guess, and maybe hope, that they'll look quite a bit different to how they do today. And though our modern economies have always been stories of how industries rise and fall, and places where we live and work and play take on different shapes in response to these shifts, today, the forces that are having an impact on the way we create prosperity are really worthy of our attention. Take the many crises that are unfolding before our eyes. COVID, climate, the collapse of the natural world, problems with loneliness and isolation, a range of entrenched socioeconomic inequalities, food security issues. You take them and put them alongside things like the multifaceted impact of technology, longer lives, the growth of cities, the changing nature of work. But you take them, you put them together, you start to see the scale of the challenges ahead. It starts to look like the current systems that we have created and through which we all live our lives today probably aren't so good at making the kind of prosperity that we are going to need to take on the big risks we face going into the future. But there is something else too. The way people think about what a good life entails is changing. We want to get involved in things, to get stuck in and sort them out. And so when we look at how this is playing out in different regions and countries, we see there are paths ahead that pioneers are opening up to create industries of the future. Ways of making economies work that take on the challenges and do so with the speed required. I'm Jimmy Greer, I'm Head of Sustainability at ACCA. And in this series, we're going to look at industries of the future and talk to some of the people that are involved in bringing them to life and the role that we can all play in being a part of them, in making them happen and in building a better world. So I wanted to start this off by thinking about the systems in which we're operating now and the places where liftoff out of them is happening. What role professional accountancy can play in making them better. And I spoke to a couple of people for whom these issues make up a big part of what they spend their time on.
So I'm John Elkington. I'm a founder and chief pollinator at Valens, based in London. And I've been involved in the environmental and then sustainability fields now for something over 40 years, mainly working with business.
As someone who's been at the forefront of thinking on this for many decades, and who, having coined the term triple bottom line, has now called for its replacement with something more appropriate, I wanted to find out from John what he was thinking about, what the state of play is, and where the shards of light are. John has just published a new book called Green Swans, The Case for Regenerative Capitalism, and I started off by asking him about what he means by the term green swans.
Well, anyone who knows the term black swan will know that Nassim Nicholas Taleb in 2007, just ahead of the 2007-09 crash, came out with his book, The Black Swan. And what he was talking about there was events or trajectories with three characteristics. The first was they blew our minds because they came out of the blue and surprised us. Secondly, they had an off-the-scale impact. And third, afterwards, we stood back or tried to and really didn't properly understand what had just happened to us. So for him, that crash was a black swan. we're now in the midst of COVID-19, and he's said that COVID-19 is not a black swan because we saw it coming. There were plenty of people who predicted pandemics, and you know, all sorts of things were put in place and quite often stripped out because people just lost interest. The idea of the green swan is a riff off that black swan concept. So basically I'm saying if a black swan is something that takes you broadly, exponentially where you don't want to go, what would it be like to have things that took you exponentially where you did want to go? And just we should always remember that exponentials often seem to be going in the wrong direction and over some time before they explode through an inflection point. So we're not instantly getting onto an upward trajectory. But so the green swan idea went into the book. The subtitle is The Coming Boom in Regenerative Capitalism. For me, capitalism is central. We have to do this through capitalism, through markets, through business. But we've got to think different. And in a sense, that's what the book was trying to prompt in readers.
So we have green swans. What about regenerative capitalism? You know, I wanted to ask John, what is it about regenerative capitalism and its coming wave? How is this different to what we have now?
Well, I think if you look at capitalism since it evolved, you know, quite a number of hundreds of years now, it is broadly degenerative. I mean, yes, it creates value. Yes, it creates products and services that people want and are prepared to pay for. But if you look at the impact on soil structures, on biodiversity, on the climate, for example, it's degenerative in the sense that over time, certainly during my lifetime of now 71 years, there's been this accelerating negative impact on the biosphere. Also, unfortunately, the current iteration of capitalism is creating massive wealth divides in our society. So this isn't simply an environmental story. It's a story around social exclusion or inclusion or whatever. And there are elements of the economic component which are also crucial. The people are increasingly worried, you know, including people like Mark Benioff, CEO of Salesforce, Warren Buffett, the investor, and so on, the Financial Times. They're basically saying capitalism is in some senses broken, even in economic terms. So it's not just the social and environmental story. And somehow we've got to put this Humpty Dumpty back together again, but not in the way that it was previously configured. We've got to do something quite different.
And when we think about putting Humpty Dumpty back together again, thoughts turn to thinking about, well, what about the triple bottom line? As I mentioned earlier, John came up with the term triple bottom line. And earlier this year, he called for a product recall of the term. I wanted to find out why he made such a bold move.
Well, just something before I say that, and yes, the triple bottom line I came up with in 1994, People, Planet, Profit, 1995. Through the late 90s, early part of this century, did a lot of work on what was originally environmental, then sustainability, now financial reporting. And I just wanted to honor the role that ACCA played in that, because when I look back at some of the early allies and partners in terms of getting triple bottom line thinking out there, ACCA was an extraordinarily thoughtful player in that space and actually quite brave at times. So I wanted to thank you for that. I've worked with companies like Toyota and Ford and so on. I know what product recalls are, and they're typically where something is out there, it's been sold, it's in operation, and it's not working in some critical way, or there is a risk around its continued use. So companies really don't want to do a product recall. So when I used that term, I knew it was provocative, because there are a lot of people out there who felt the triple bottom line was doing excellent work. So you have Dow Jones Sustainability Indexes, you know, completely triple bottom line. You have Global Reporting Initiative, Integrated Reporting, and so on, all again around the triple bottom line. You've got the B Corporation movement, which I love. Again, 3,500 pushing towards 4,000 companies around the world, absolutely focused on the triple bottom line. So why in God's name would I recall it? And the answer was quite simple. It was actually 2 years ago. It was 2018, June, and it was through the Harvard Business Review. And HBR told me, the editors there told me, it was the first time in their knowledge that any management concept had been subject to a product recall. The reason I did it was that I thought that despite the good work that was being done, particularly by thoughtful businesses and players and so on, people had misinterpreted the idea of the triple bottom line, which wasn't simply about trade-offs. How do I get economic value, financial value, a bit of social value? Actually, it's unfortunate that the environment suffers, but you know, that's all in the triple bottom line framework. It's a trade-off, and environment loses, or society loses. And the original intent of the triple bottom line was system change. And I felt that to some considerable degree that had been lost along the way. People felt as long as you engage stakeholders across those different areas, as long as you did your reporting and the rest of it, that was enough. And you know, the whole ESG, environment, social and governance investment movement, is it predicated on that as well. And I was just saying, are we really sure that's true? Are we really sure if we continue to do even more and more of this sort of work, that that's going to turn the super tanker around or really drive the right sort of system change? My conclusion was it wasn't, and it won't. It was a provocation. Actually, just finally, one of the things I've been very pleased about is that almost without exception, the responses I've had have been extremely positive. You know, thank you for doing this. So it isn't that I haven't had some critics. Of course, they're always there. But several of the most vociferous ones have actually come around over time. So that was the background on that. Now, I'd watch companies, including companies that we work with, going through the process, for example, with the United Nations Global Goals, the Sustainable Development Goals. So basically, the question they asked themselves very often was, what are we already doing? And how does that map onto the Sustainable Development Goals? What claims can we make in relation to that much bigger agenda? And that's where we all start. And I'm not against incrementalism. I think it's, we all start at fairly basic levels and all of this. But if companies deluded themselves, and many of them began to do that, that that was enough, then I thought we had a big problem on our hands. Now, over time, I think what's happened is that not necessarily directly because of the product recall, but the notion of a systemic crisis is increasingly present in people's minds. The sense that incrementalism is fine, but you've really got to think systemically and work out how you can drive increasingly systemic change. That's become mainstream in a way that I wouldn't have said it was at all 4 or 5 years ago. So the needle has shifted, and I'm actually quite excited. And oddly, I think COVID-19 is driving the process very, very powerfully indeed. And not always in the right direction, but it's certainly providing momentum.
And so it seems like thinking about systems and changing those systems has moved into the mainstream. And when we think about the setting for industries of the future, I wanted to ask John, who are the thinkers and what are the kind of frameworks that he has used over the years for navigating the big changes that we see that will help us as we move forwards?
There were two economists who've always lived on in my mind. One was Nikolai Kondratiev, who was shot for telling Stalin what Stalin did not want to hear, which is that there are these moments when capitalism collapses, almost like a forest fire ripping through a forest, but then it comes back stronger. And Stalin and his cronies felt that capitalism was flat in its face in the depression and would stay there. And I think we're at one of those points again. And so Joseph Schumpeter picked up the same story. And that sense of waves and cycles and going up and going down, that stuck with me very strongly. And then the second person that you kindly mentioned was Thomas Kuhn and his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which I read when I was a teenager. And it had a profound influence on me. I've gone back to the book a number of times since. It's a very difficult book to read. But the proposition is very simple, that science proceeds in these convulsive shifts where you go from one perceived reality, you know, everything goes around the earth, to, you know, a heliocentric world where we're going around the sun and the sun's going around everything else. And, you know, moving from one reality to another is really disconcerting, almost nauseating to people who have to go through that process, which is why it's very often a generational process. There are people who've been infected with the old paradigm who can't make the transition. And there are younger people who come through who just think differently from the outset. So it's not as disconcerting to them. And I think we're there, both in the cycles, the waves. I think we're in a profound down wave. One of the first diagram in the book is called the U-bend. And this was done, I've been talking about it for 2 years, but this was put in the book late last year. And it basically is where we are now with COVID-19. It's accelerated the process. But I'm saying this isn't going to be a V-shaped or a U-shaped or a W-shaped recovery. There will be elements of that through, but we're in a 12 to 15 year process where an old order comes apart and a new one is struggling to be born. So there'll be accountants sort of in the old order struggling to make sense of what's happening all around them. And there'll be people to a lesser degree in the new order trying to make sense of where that's all headed. But I think accounting has to be in service of the future. Though, you know, that's why for me, Kondratiev, Schumpeter and Kuhn were actually quite formative.
And John, so links that, because those models are really helpful, I think, for us to, as we are sort of plotting out, certainly where finance, where do accountants sit in all of these moves and how can they position themselves to be useful and do great things for their organizations. Useful, sorry for saying that. But another thing that you have, well, certainly introduced me to, and since then I've been looking and seeing how others are using it as well, are the three horizons.
Yeah.
And perhaps you could explain a little bit about the three horizons and how that can be a helpful way to chart how we're thinking about the future.
Well, there are a number of three horizon models out there. McKinsey have one, which is sort of a succession of S-curves. This is by Bill Sharp. It's very different. And it basically talks about three horizons or three worlds in a way. And the first one, let's assume it's our world. It's the reality that we've grown up with. But it's starting to weaken over time. Then right in the future, and we can argue about what sort of future we're talking about. Is it the 2030s? Is it the 2050s? Is it the latter part of the century or what? You've got a world that is transformed. And in the middle, you've got a second horizon. And that's where people like Ronnie Cohen with the impact revolution and so on are playing. They're giving us the mindsets. They're giving us the tools that we're going to use in the next sort of 10 to 15 years and so on. But the longer term horizon is one in which, you know, economics is transformed. We don't think about GDP and GNP in the way that we thought about it previously. And it's not because we decide not to think about it. Just that isn't the way things are done. And I think in a way, one of the most exciting things at the moment is there are so many technologies that are coming through, primarily driven by digitization. And so you've got autonomous vehicles, you've got the Internet of Everything, you've got synthetic biology, you've got drones and satellite remotes. All of these things sort of coming into a new economy. I absolutely do not believe that that is guaranteed to create the right sort of outcomes. I think it will be better, and that's almost guaranteed, but there will be unintended consequences. So the question is, can accounting move from that backward-looking thing of saying, how did we do in the last accounting period? To, well, that's interesting, but where are we actually trying to head? And what, how is value going to be created in that world? And how does our business model and our organization play into that new world of value creation? Now, most accountants are almost by definition and by training and almost by natural selection much more inclined to think backwards than they are forwards. But we're one of those moments where we've all got to step up and we've all got to think forwards.
Long waves, cycles, paradigm shifts. These are the ways that we ought to be thinking about how we are going to operate in the future, where we are, and how we can be part of industries of the future. I finally wanted to ask John what he thinks is the big thing that we should really be looking out for. Where is the space opening up for us all to really think about change happening?
Well, it's interesting because when I first came into this area professionally, I was working, for example, on environmental impact assessment studies in places like Egypt. This was the sort of early, mid 1970s. And there the focus was almost exclusively on negative impacts. And over a period of time, we became aware that a whole range of different impacts were taking us in the wrong direction. And one of the things I've done since more or less the sort of mid late 80s is to track the societal pressure waves that have forced business and increasingly financial markets to do new things. And I've tracked five of those waves up to the present day. I do think there's a sixth one building. I do think that's around impact. I think it's going to be less visible in some ways than some of the others, because it's going to be around a different form of professional approach to these sorts of issues. So a lot of that will help happen inside organizations, businesses, industries, and so on. But I think for the next sort of 5 to 10 years, impact is going to be a central theme. And financial markets are talking about ESG and so on, but they really are still struggling to properly understand not just how impact should be thought about, but how you value it. And just this morning, I was on a call with Novartis, the Swiss pharmaceutical company. I chair an advisory board there, which is about impact valuation. You know, I'm as nervous as the next person about slapping a financial price tag on everything that moves in the value landscapes and of social, ethical, environmental, or whatever. And yet, if markets are going to properly engage with this, we do need to be able to put at least proxy values on some of these things. So it's a struggle, but there's some very brave companies beginning to start out on that journey. And I think by 2030, we'll look back at a sort of almost a professional toolkit, which has evolved in the meantime, which doesn't simply take negative impact, which is where I started, but positive impact as social entrepreneurs and impact investors have begun to think about it. But big companies will then be thinking about it too. They'll have no choice.
Thinking about how we're going to mainstream impact and take on the big challenges of the future, I want to introduce our second interviewee from the other side of the world, working across Asia on social impact.
So I'm Naina Sabharwal Batra. I'm the CEO and chairperson of ABPN, which is a network for social investors. And it's a membership network. We have more than 600 members who come from 36 markets. And they range from grant makers to family offices to investors, corporates, and policymakers, all of whom are looking at how can they more effectively and more impactfully deploy their capital in Asia. So at ABPN, we adopt a connect, learn, lead philosophy in everything that we do. So connect is we actually use the network to convene and identify the right kind of partners who can scale impact. We help foster learning through our knowledge center by facilitating knowledge sharing, helping people sort of share best practices and lessons, and leadership through advocating for high impact causes that have the potential for systemic change.
And thinking about AVPN with its members operating across the whole of Asia, with the view of these systemic issues, with pioneers in social impact investing and social entrepreneurship, trying to take them on, take these big challenges on, their work really holds many of the keys to kind of unlocking these multidimensional issues across so many different domains. And I think what's so interesting here is that for them, as a network, they are bringing people together of different types, finding ways to collaborate and do things, scale with capital to make an impact.
So I'll give you an example. One of our members actually ended up working with the Ministry of Health in India, as well, along with an SME that specialized in AI, to look at bringing AI technology to healthcare access in one of the poorest countries of the world.
And so we have these existing challenges, the new layer of the COVID-19 crisis. We have a near-term need to support livelihoods, but also to really think about how we build better out of this. How do we reconnect the world? And how do we rewire it?
We focus on how we build back global value chains. You know, how do we look at the environmental impact that these value chains have? If you're talking about the garment industry, how do we look at to make sure that, you know, there is, we are employing the principles of fair trade. We are looking at, you know, the quality of work life for garment workers. I mean, this is the time, and this is the time where we risk losing even whatever actual gains we had made in the past, because industries are so pressed and they're under so much financial pressure that they are just least likely, unfortunately, to now go back and say, oh, I'm going to invest in a better work practice, or I'm going to actually invest in technology, which in the short term may be more expensive, but in the long term will give me, you know, a better, more environmentally sustainable production chain. I mean, that is something that we are at risk of losing. And unfortunately, it's like an elephant in the room. We all know that this is important, but we are reluctant to address it because we are saying, okay, at this point, the need of the hour is to get that business up and running. And any which how. And that's not necessarily correct. And that is where I think the voices need to be strong and they need to be kind of more unified. I mean, that you know, this change that has been worked on so hard.
Not losing gains that have been made because of a need to get things back up and running fast is something that's really important to Naina. I wanted to ask Naina, what the business world that isn't part of this social investment work can learn from them. How can businesses use their skills and take on these challenges, build industries of the future that will take on more social environmental challenges and deliver positive impact? Thinking about how to seed and build these new systems and solutions, she came up with a super suggestion.
So I think what businesses, mainstream businesses, bring to the impact sector is their experience with scale and with, you know, taking products to market. A lot of times we find that businesses that are, you know, sort of in the social space and the ones that get access to patient capital or first loss capital are usually, you know, just are very nascent. They are probably, you know, at Series A stage or at best between Series A and Series B. You know, and it's tough for them to sort of look at both in terms of the human capital bit, you know, in terms of the entrepreneur actually having had that experience in terms of how do they scale up that business to make it more mainstream and to take that technology or to take that impact principle to a larger group of customers, a larger group of stakeholders. And that is where I feel mainstream business can play a huge role, because a lot of times, the patient capital that these businesses, that these ideas, that these social entrepreneurs have access to, help them de-risk that business. And it is then easier for a mainstream business, for a more established business, to try and see if they can either incubate them or then invest in them to take them to the next level. And that's where, you know, it's a good model for mainstream businesses to actually have that relationship, which is much less riskier, with the kind of more socially focused, more impact focused, more sort of, you know, environmentally, socially business models that can be tried and tested and piloted, but then hopefully scaled up using both the managerial know-how, but also the distribution networks that these more established businesses have access to.
And so alongside the role for business, I wanted to know from Naina more about what she thinks is happening with investors. Are those that we want to help catalyze these shifts ready to get a move on and get involved?
I think one of the things, if not anything else, that this pandemic has done, and you know, all the sort of social issues that have come to the fore that were already there, whether it's about, you know, the inequalities that exist in different societies, the kind of lack of inclusivity, etc., etc. What it's really happened now is that I think there is a overpowering, almost, you know, sort of universal belief that things have to change. And they need to change, keeping our communities, our societies much more in the forefront, and profit can no longer be the sole motivator. You know, as cliched as that sounds, and I'm often very cynical about statements like this, but now I find more and more and more organizations, as well as large funds, really talking or starting to say, hey, maybe wait a minute, let me just also think about what I'm doing or where I'm investing and the companies that I'm investing in, what are they doing? So, you know, what is the footprint that they are creating? So, you know, maybe there is a room for cautious optimism that, you know, we will actually start looking at the triple bottom line, and not just because it sounds good, but because it really is good.
And so I asked Naina what she thinks is holding this back from really becoming mainstream. What are the drivers out of the crisis? And where organizations like ACCA can play a role?
I think that's, you know, that is the most important question, actually. And that is where I think, you know, networks like yours, like ACCA, should be taking a leading role. You know, if we are really planning to mainstream impact, the most important need of the hour is to have a standardized metric for measurement. The problem we have right now is when you look at sort of patient capital, first loss capital, people say, oh, you know, that's, I'm going to look at it. I'm anyway going to give that money away. I'm not expecting anything back. So how stringent am I going to be about impact? I'm fine with a qualitative measure. It can differ from this investment to that investment. But really, if you look at it, that kind of investment is at best 5% of the investor's portfolio. And if we want to really drive change, you know, across all sections and segments of society, we need to be engaging with the 100% of that portfolio. And every investment we make, whether it's for financial returns, market level returns, sub-market returns, you know, market plus returns, needs to have an impact component to it. And that will only happen if we can have a standardized metric. Now, if you look at accounting standards, I mean, they only came into play in the early 1900s, right? So it's not as if it happened, we've had them forever. I think we need to sit down and work together. We are, AVPN is working with the IMP project, but I do believe that we need a standardized metric. I mean, even if you look at ESG, right, it only started kind of, you know, gaining in steam when you had ESG standards that were accepted and understood by investment managers and investment advisors. Otherwise, it's like, you know, comparing apples and oranges. Should I invest in education or should I invest in gender? Should I look at healthcare or should I look at climate change? I mean, you tell me, right? What is better? Where do I get more bang for my buck? Oh my God, you know, climate change takes too long. Not worth it. I'll just, you know, pay for 10 kids to go to school. I mean, it's literally as trivial as that. And that's not how we are going to mainstream it. So I think, you know, ACCA has a huge role to play because you have access to this huge community that actually brings together accounting standards, which we all, you know, I mean, we all take that as gospel truth. How do we actually incorporate impact standards into those accounting standards? I think that's the key. If we can do that, we will be able to, you know, every investor, every corporate, nobody wants to do badly. But at this point, we are rewarding them on something else. And we're saying, okay, now, but also please look at this. Very important.
And finally, I asked Naina what she saw as the one big issue where change needed to happen fast. Her answer?
So I think it's really important, right? Especially for us in Asia. I think we have to be very cognizant of what is happening in the West. And, you know, you see now a lot more public sort of outcry about the inequality that actually, the systemic inequality that is existing, right? And that is going to be something that I think will spread to Asia if we don't act in the next 10 years. You know, it is the part of the world where wealth is being created faster than anywhere else. But it is also the part of the world where income inequalities are huge in certain countries. And how are we going to address that? How are we going to actually look at sort of making sure that it's not just a very slow trickle down, but it actually is sort of, you know, economic success is coming down to all levels and all layers. And I think that's where it's important. It's also interesting because in Asia, over the next 10 years, we are going to see the biggest transfer of wealth from the, you know, older generation to the next generation. The maximum amount of wealth in Asia is concentrated in family offices. And that's where that wealth transfer is going to happen. So I actually am pretty optimistic because I feel that the newer generation is much more socially conscious and socially aware and are not sort of, you know, as old school about philanthropy and investment being two separate pools and are much more interested in seeing how can we combine the two to make sure that, you know, whatever we are doing is more impactful, doesn't cause harm, etc., etc. So I actually think that, you know, in the next 10 years, it could be that Asia shows the rest of the world that this is the way to go. And this is how you can actually drive economic progress, but also be inclusive as you do it.
That's all for this episode. I hope you've enjoyed listening to our guests and it has helped set the scene for the world that industries of the future are emerging into. We'll be back soon with episode 2. This series comes to you from ACCA, with production and original music by Snow Lion Media.
This podcast was brought to you by ACCA. Find out how we think ahead at accaglobal.com.